Hello and welcome to Bat Flips and Nerds, the baseball podcast with a British twist. And I am your host today, John McGee. And I'm joined by a very special guest, a man who has notched up an 11-year baseball career across six major league franchises, reaching the majors with the Padres and retiring after breaking the minor league home run record. He is the beating heart of the Israeli national baseball team. And he was the host with his wife, Jen, of Radio.com's brilliant Swings and Misses. He's also baseball's biggest Oasis, Doctor Who and Top Gear fan. Welcome, Cody Decker. How are you?
It was eight teams, not six.
Eight.
Goodness, yeah, I can't count. The Padres, Red Sox, Rockies, Royals. That's four. Uh-huh. Let's go. Diamondbacks, Mets, Brewers. I'm missing one. Who was the last one? There's another team in there that I played for, I think. I don't know. It was a long time, man. And I used to drink a lot.
Yeah, I'm looking it up now. Yeah, I can't see who else it was, but I'm going to... Yeah, I remember you being on the Brewers as well, because...
I was only in spring training. They released me at the end of spring training because, you know, it was my own fault. I didn't get out all of spring training, so why keep me? Ended up signing with the Mets, which was great. I loved playing for the Mets organization. It was actually quite enjoyable. I liked it a lot. They were really nice people. They were a mess, but man, were they nice. I loved them. I really enjoyed it. I wanted to go back.
So we are going to get into your sort of Anglophile nature. We've been chatting on DMs for the last couple of weeks, and some of the British stuff that you are into is pretty cool. So we'll get into that in a bit, but we should talk a bit about baseball. We've been talking a bit about the off season before we hit the record button, but let's talk about you. Let's get people over here in the UK who maybe don't know who Cody Decker is. Tell them who you are, right? So you are, I know who you are, but people who are listening to this podcast maybe don't know all about you. So what's the potted biography?
All right, let's go through the quick thing. The quick thing about my career is very simple. You ever see Bull Durham? You ever see Crash Davis? I'm him. I'm Crash Davis. I got my 20 days in the show, didn't really play, got one start, and I spent the rest of my career basically in AAA and setting records and never really getting the opportunities that I really thought I kind of deserved. But, you know, that's not for me to really say, even though I'll say it anyways. I had a fairly good reputation around the league, being a clubhouse guy. So towards the end of my career, I was even told, like, by the organizations, specifically the Diamondbacks, like, hey, we need you to be the Crash Davis guy. We need you to mentor our young players, and maybe you'll get to the big leagues if you play really well. And I was, but, you know, my playing time was sparing. They even told me before the season, hey, man, if we're in last place in the National League West and we have the opportunity to, because you're killing it in AAA, if we have the chance to call you up at 32 years old or a 22-year-old prospect, we're going to bring up the 22-year-old prospect, Cody. I'm sorry. And I'm like, well, that, you know, that sucks to hear, but I appreciate the honesty. But my favorite thing about the whole Crash Davis analogy always was whenever somebody tried to make the insult on Twitter, like, oh, whatever, Crash Davis. I'm like, why do you think that's an insult? You mean the most nuanced and flushed out character in all of sports movies of all time, the wisest character in all of sports movies? That's a compliment, so suck it.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, he even over here in the UK, you know, we were talking about a completely minority sport. Everyone knows Bull Durham in the UK. So, you know, you are the real life embodiment of that.
You know what
vibe.
Sucks, though? I never got the nickname. I was always always Deck, you know, and think about it. Decker and Davis is still a two syllable word that starts with a D. How did I not get Crash Decker? I could be walking around with the name Crash right now. Instead, I got Cody, which is as terrible of a first name as it gets.
Well, let's start the campaign right now. You should be Crash Decker for time immemorial from now.
I feel like it's a little late now, man. I've been retired for a year and a half, 2 years.
Right, so let's talk about your retirement, because if people know you've got a cursory interest in baseball, that they maybe know you because of how you retired. So you retired the day after you broke the minor league home run record. Was that something that you had been planning on doing,
No, not at all. And in fact, that is a little bit of a slight misinformation. I don't have the minor league home run record. I was, however, the minor league home run record belongs to Mike Hessman. Hessman had hit like 400 home runs. He played for like 35 years, though. I played for 11. I hit 200 and I think 8 or 9 home runs. Mm-hmm. And but I was the active leader when I retired. Oh, and by active, I mean I had more home runs in the minor leagues than anyone by like 100. I had a lot of home runs. And,
right.
So that's what I was. my final game was very interesting. I retired on July 7th, 2019. For a couple of years, I'd turned down some media jobs, radio shows, TV shows. I wasn't done playing. I felt like I belonged in the big leagues and I felt like I deserved an opportunity and I was going to keep going until I got it. And I kept saying, until they take the jersey away from me, I'm not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to keep doing this. But at one point, I finally, you know, I got put on the DL a couple of times, the Phantom DL. Yeah. Which means you're not hurt. They need your roster spot. And when I found out, when they first put me on the Phantom DL, I went like, you can't be serious. I was, it was in April of 2018 with the Diamondbacks, who I love. I have nothing but praise for the Diamondbacks. What a wonderful organization. Great people. But I was leading the AAA in our home runs and RBI. I was off to a great start to the season. I get a phone call and I think I'm getting called up to the big leagues. And they're like, hey, we just called up Christopher Negron. I'm like, great. I love Negron. That's great. That's an odd thing to call me about. So I'm waiting for him to say, and you're going with him. And what he followed up by saying was, so we need a shortstop at AAA and we need your roster spot. And I immediately just dropped the phone. I'm like, what? He's like, yeah. So we could send you to AA to get at bats. And I just stared on the phone. I'm just like, I'm good. I'm good. You mean I can sit on the bench in AAA or I can go to Jackson, Tennessee? I'll stay in Reno. I'm good. Thank you. So I remember I got on the Phantom and I got on and off the Phantom for the rest of the year. And I was just like, man, is this really where I'm at? I go on playing the games. I'm playing great, but I just can't really get an opportunity. And I ended up signing back with the team the next year because mm-hmm. I just loved the organization. And it just seemed like I was spinning my wheels and there was really nowhere to go. And, you know, I wouldn't say my stats were suffering. I think I hit like 260 off the bench in 2018. And then in 2019, I was hitting 240 off the bench. And I don't know if you've ever played baseball, but hitting off the bench at a high level is next to impossible. It's just frighteningly difficult. You're cold for 3 hours. Hey, you're going to go face the closer who's throwing 98 to 101 and you're a power guy. So you're actually going up there trying to hit a home run. That's it. And you know, it's the most thankless job in the world going in to pinch hit late in the game. And he's like, listen, we're just throwing darts at a wall and hoping it sticks, man. I loved the role though. I started to relish the role and I got pretty good at the role. And I wish to God, I learned how to do that role years earlier. Mm. But I didn't. I was an everyday player. I went to the big leagues and they said, okay, you're going to go pinch hit. When was the last time you had an at bat? I said, 3 weeks ago. They're like, okay, wow. Well, Madison Bumgarner's got a perfect game in the eighth. You're going to go face him. Good luck. I'm like, oh, okay. So when I struck out that at bat, they're like, I don't know if Decker can handle the big leagues. I'm like, I faced Madison like 40 times in my career. I think I've homered off him twice. I can face him just fine. Let me play. It's just baseball's weird, man. It's a tough business. But I look back at my career with literally no regrets. But to get back to the initial point, because I think I went off in four tangents, is my final game. It was as Crash Davis as it gets. If you see Bull Durham, you know, Crash hit his last home run, got his record and left. Mm-hmm. I hit my 200th home run, and that was a goal. I wanted to hit 200 home runs. That was kind of a cool thing to do. But then I got put back on the Phantom after I was hit the 200th home run. And I just went, man, this sucks. It's fine. I'm going to just make sure the clubhouse is loose and take care of my guys and be kind of an extension of a coaching staff. But it was starting to really wear on me. And I got a phone call from radio.com sports and they just basically said, we want to offer you a job. We want to fly you out to Boston and do a couple of test shows. So I flew out to Boston. The Diamondbacks allowed me to fly to Boston. I just couldn't tell anybody. We did a couple of test shows and I had an offer on the table the next week while simultaneously having an offer to return to a city I really love in El Paso, Texas. I played AAA baseball in El Paso, Texas, and I fell in love with this place. And I saw an opportunity to, help run a baseball and softball nonprofit and run a baseball facility and build programs and try and change the lives of some young student athletes, trying to get them into college through baseball and softball. So I was able to do both of those. And it was just kind of a perfect situation. So I called the Diamondbacks. I said, listen, I'm going to take these offers. I'm going to retire at the end of the week. Is that okay? And they were very wonderful about it. It was like, hey, we're about to take you off the Phantom. Do you want to play? I said, yeah, obviously I want to play. So I go into my last game playing left field. I haven't played in a while. And I remember my first three at-bats, I K'd three times. And I hadn't had an at-bat in a month. I was just like, oh, thank God I'm retiring, man. This sucks. Like, I haven't seen a guy throw above batting practice speed in a month. I'm sitting here Kang three times, man. I'm done. So glad. And we get to the like seventh inning. I come up with bases loaded with two, and I have two strikes, and we're down by one. And I hit a line drive single on the left to tie the game. And we take the lead. I'm in left field in the ninth inning with the one run lead, thinking, going, you know, one for four for my final game, game tying RBI single, win the game. It's a good way to go out. It's a good last one. My last at bat was line drive RBI single to tie the game. That's good. I like it. And then our closer was Jimmy Scherfy, who is a great pitcher. It does not blow saves. And for whatever reason, he blew a save this game. And I was furious. I was in left field. They scored two runs. We're down by one. And I look up at the scoreboard. I see the lineup. And I'm like, I'm hitting third next in. I'm like, whatever. I don't care. I'm going to hit a walk. And I said it out loud. And I never do this. I actually yelled out loud. Are we allowed to cuss?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, thank you. You could hear me audibly in left field yell, fuck it, I'll hit a walk-off next inning. But it wasn't at that point. I was just mad we weren't winning. I forgot everything else. I forgot that, I'm retiring in 25 minutes. But none of that. The only people that knew were the Diamondbacks, my family, and our announcer. The fans didn't know. No one knew. No one knew this was my final game. And I remember I get into the ninth. We get a guy on base. I come up to the plate and they have their closer throwing and he can throw. He's got 97 to 101. This guy can really chuck it. And I'm like, all in my head, get on time to the fastball. That's it. Just get on time to the fastball. If he throws me three bastard sliders, he deserves to get my ass out. First pitch fastball, I foul it back and I step out of the box and I yell at myself again. And I'm surprised the catcher called another fastball after this because I yelled at myself. You could see me walk out and I kind of hit my head with the bat. I'm like, get on time to the fastball, you stupid son of a bitch. I get back in the box, throws me another fastball, and I absolutely hammered it. And my first thought was right off the bat, I knew it was gone. I've done it enough at that point. I never pimped home runs, but that's not because I'm against pimping home runs. I have no swag at all. So like when you see Fernando Tatis Jr. hit a home run and have a 10-minute tea party at home plate, know that I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. I just can't do it. It looks stupid when I do it.
Yeah.
Because, and also in my head, I'm also Jewish. So in my head, when I hit a ball that I know is gone, I'm like, I'm going to watch this. But then, you know, my Jewishness kicks in and I just hear in the back of my head, oh, so special. What if it goes off the wall? Get on second base. What? You're not going to get extra bases and not be in scoring position. So I always just take off until it goes over. But I hammered this ball. I took off and I never slowed down. I kept my same speed running around the bases because I was just too charged up, too fired up. Guys were going crazy in the dugout and meeting me at home plate. And we were just the longest hugs at home plate. And it's not even registering to me that this is it. Like, I think subconsciously I knew this was it. But, like, it was so emotional. And even players on their team went up to one of our teammates. He's like, hey, that was a bit much. He's like, dude, that's his last at bat. He's retiring tonight. And they're like, oh, well, hug for longer then. And I remember it didn't register to me until I got back in the dugout. I go up to the helmet rack and take my helmet off. I take off my batting gloves and I put my batting gloves in my helmet and I go and put the helmet in the helmet rack and I immediately pause because I'm like, holy shit, this is the last time I'm ever putting my helmet into a helmet rack. Like, it just all of a sudden hit me like a ton of bricks. And I just pause and I look to my right and Johnny Gomes was our head outfield coordinator. He was there that day and he's literally standing next to my face, just right here. But staring at me, and I didn't even realize it because I was in my own world at that moment. And I turned my right and Johnny's just, I'm like, oh, hey, Johnny. And I just went, Johnny, I'm retiring. And he just goes, I know. This is the most awesome thing I've ever watched. And he immediately grabs my bat and he runs away. And I'm just like, well, I guess I won't see that again. And what he did was he wrapped it up and he just said, this bat never touches the baseball ever again. It's framed at my parents' house.
Amazing.
I remember I was starting to walk. I tried to walk into the clubhouse and my teammate, I didn't notice all my teammates were in the dugout. The guys came in from the bullpen. They literally picked me up and threw me out on the field for a curtain call. The crowd was like 9,000 people giving me a huge ovation and they didn't know what they were giving me ovation for. Just, they think they were giving me an ovation for the walk-off, which made me actually happier going like, I earned this. I earned this curtain call. I really did. And this is really, really cool. And, it was an emotional moment. We went in the clubhouse. Guys were there. with shots ready to go, and just everybody was just gave me speeches and told me what I meant to them, and I told them what they meant to me, and it was just the most emotional night of maybe my life. It was a lot of, I wouldn't say mixed feelings. There was a little bit of bittersweetness, obviously, because that's, you know, it's hard. You know, at the end of, when you watch the end of Bull Durham, when he's sitting there and he's talking to Susan Sarandon and he says, "Do you think I can make it to the show as a manager?" That's a wonderful yet heart-wrenching moment. And yeah, that's kind of what I was feeling that night. It was a combination of, this is wonderful, but also this just, I feel like I'm stabbing myself a little. But it was a really wonderful night. I got to share that with maybe the best teammates I ever had in my career. I had guys like Caleb Joseph that was there. I had guys like Travis Snyder that were there, guys that mean the absolute world to me. It was just a really cool way to go out.
That's incredible. In fact, thank you for reliving that with us. Just such an incredible story. Absolutely magically told. I was completely rapt listening to you. So I wanted to talk a bit about your minor league career, because one of the things about you, like, so I've been sort of aware of you as a player for you know, a while now. So, you know, for the last 10 years or so. And one thing that I remember hearing about you doing loads was being really adaptable. Like, I remember you being in the Boston organization. You said before we started that I'm a Red Sox fan, and playing at catcher in Portland, which is a position that you hadn't played before. You know, just for
I dabbled a little bit in it. I went to UCLA as a catcher in college. I caught some games for the Padre organization, but then I would go like 2 years without doing it. And I remember when I signed with the Red Sox, I was like, "Hey guys, you know I can catch too." And they're like, "You can?" I said, "Yeah." Like, "Well, okay, you're gonna go catch." I was like, "Okay." You are right to be a Red Sox fan. I've had the luxury of playing for some amazing organizations. I haven't been quiet that the very top of my list was the Diamondbacks of the teams I got to play for, just how they treated me, treat other players, and how easy they are to work with. I mean, they were just wonderful, wonderful, the Diamondbacks. I don't have enough not pleasant things to say about the Diamondbacks. But the Red Sox are right there too. The Red Sox, you know, I just finished playing. I started that year with the Royals. I got traded to the Rockies. And then after traded to the Rockies, they released me after like 2 weeks. It was not a good experience with the Rockies, unfortunately. And then I signed with the Red Sox. And then, you know, of course, I had to kind of swallow a bit of a bitter pill and go to AA, which I hadn't been in AA at that point in like 7 years. But I did it, and I went there, and I had a good time. I was dealing with some – to be honest with you, I talked to somebody else about this recently. When I went to the Red Sox, I wasn't me. I mean, personality-wise, I was, but I would go home, and I would struggle with some serious mental health issues. I was so scared of getting released again. So I was at the point where I was walking to the batter's box, my hands would start shaking, because every time I went to the box, I'm like, if I strike out and get fired, I'm never playing baseball again. And I just played scared. It was the worst experience of my life personally, but the Red Sox were understanding of that. And, you know, I got to speak to some coaches. I got to speak to some mental health coaches that they had over there at my disposal. They were just so great. And I remember the last game of that year, we were playing on the road at New Hampshire, which is the Toronto Blue Jays. And I knew in my heart, the year was just a complete and utter failure. I hit like 240 on the year. I hit 19 home runs, but I struck out a lot. I just wasn't me. I knew that. And it was really bugging me that I couldn't find myself when I was with the Red Sox organization. I had spurts of it. I had moments where I was like, there you are. Now that's you. And then I would just kind of go right back to where I was. But I remember I got called in the office, and the assistant GM for the Red Sox was there. And he kind of hugged me and said, "I just want you to know what you did this year." And he pulled out some stats, and he's like, "I know you feel like you failed, but you led this organization in every power category since you've come here. I know your strikeouts were high, but your RBIs, your hard contacts, your home run, your extra base hits, your total bases, you led the organization in all of that." He's like, "So this was not the failure you think it is, and how you handled." And when I came there, they even told me, "Listen, Portland, our team has 20 wins right now. They're like 20 and 60. And we have major prospects there. We had Yoan Moncada there. We had Benintendi there." Benintendi at the time was hitting like 116. And I remember my first time I got there, I kind of like me and Benintendi became kind of friendly, and he started going off. And I remember watching him going like, "Guys, this guy's a star." This guy might be one of the most talented players I've ever seen. And I look over to the shortstop, I see Mankata. I'm like, that guy's got some talent too. My God, there's some talent on this field. Then we got Mauricio Dubon. I'm like, these guys are stars. These three are legitimate stars in the making. I had it in that exact order: Benintendi, Mankata, Dubon. But that's, don't think for a second that that can't be interchangeable. Those three are stupendous ball players. And I remember after that, specifically Dubon hugged me. There was one day where I got into Dubon's ass a little bit. I had to yell at him because he made a bad throw, and he gave me a look because I couldn't pick it for him. And he looked at me, and I was at first base. I'm like, are you shitting me? And we go in the dugout, and I screamed at him. I'm like, you're going to sit here and show me up because you made a bad throw, yada, yada, yada. Just high intensity. And I went up to the plate, and I homered. And I come back in, he was the first guy to meet me there with a hug. He's like, you're welcome. I pissed you off enough. And we, I love that kid. I just love that kid.
Yeah, he was always a favorite of mine when he was in that org. And we have a guy who rides for us on the Giants who just loves the kid. Absolutely.
Oh, I love him. He is so cocky and arrogant, but man, is he the best. I just can't get enough of him. I love a little bit of swag, man. I really do. If you're cocky and arrogant on the field, but you can back it up and you can also have some fun with it, I love you. I absolutely love you. It's the guys that are just assholes for the sake of being assholes. So that's not good for a clubhouse. That's not good for anybody. But if you're kind of like an arrogant guy who says something good about himself and then immediately says something self-deprecating, you can't get enough of those guys. I love it. And Dubon is one of those kids. And I just love the kid. It's just, I've been very lucky to play for some great people and be around this league. And yes, you are totally right to love the Red Sox. And I love the Red Sox.
Well, that's awesome to hear that they looked after you like that. If you don't mind, can we just sort of touch on that for a minute? It's interesting that I didn't know that about you. And I didn't know that you'd gone through that experience whilst you were in Portland. And it's something that's, you know, been brought into the spotlight recently through the experiences of Drew Robinson, primarily, but then other players like Rob Whalen being really, really open about his own struggles. Is it something that is, I wouldn't say more prevalent behind the scenes, but something that there's more sort of infrastructure in place to look after people who are in your circumstances? Or were you just particularly fortunate that you were with the Red Sox? I mean, is it something that's on the quiet, more common than fans think it is?
I think it's a little more common than people think, but there's still that old school mentality. I think right now people are really starting to go after mental health a little more, which is really a good thing. I think Major League Baseball, despite the business of Major League Baseball being as ugly as it is, they did something really great recently, and that's changing their drug testing policy, for one. And I know that doesn't sound like it's linked to mental health, but it actually is. It used to be the drug testing policy was if you get popped for any type of drug of abuse, you're immediately suspended. No pay, go home. Unfortunately, a friend of a lot of ours, Tyler Skaggs, passed away last year, a year and a half ago, and it really broke the hearts of all of us. I've known Tyler since he was a little kid. He went to my high school. He was a wonderful, wonderful guy. I cannot stress that enough. But after he passed away, they kind of revamped how they were going to go about drug testing. No more immediate suspensions. Instead, it's treatment. If you get caught, if you test positive for any drug of abuse, you go to treatment. And I think that is a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's a bold thing in the step in the right direction, because it's so easy for athletes, especially baseball players. You're playing 162 games every single day. I never played a game not in a lot of pain. I was always in pain. My hands are chronically in pain. My feet are chronically in pain. My back always hurts. Like, I'm always hurting. So we couldn't, you know, take any type of drugs. You would hear rumblings of guys getting their hands on some sort of opioid just to go to sleep at night, or guys would drink a half bottle of vodka every night so they can sleep. And guys end up accidentally self-medicating, and then it just becomes common practice. And I'm really glad that Major League Baseball took a step in that right direction. And I think it was like the thing that no one wanted to talk about, and mental health is very much linked in that. It's the thing that's there that we all struggle with, but no one wants to talk about it because it's taboo. It's soft. You can't be soft playing professional sports. You got to be tough. You got to just grind through and get past it. Oh, the guy's soft. No, he's not. Like, this is, it's a grind. You're away from your home for 8 months. You're in a town you've never heard of. You can't pay for your bill. You can't pay your bills. You can't pay for your rent. I played my first time in AAA was in 2012 in Tucson, Arizona for the Tucson Padres. I remember I got called up there midseason. I was playing in San Antonio in AA. And I remember very specifically, you're going to AAA. And I was really excited. First time in AAA. I'm just one step away. I'm right there. And then I get there, but I had to fly. They wouldn't let me drive my car. I had to ship my car, but I had to do that out of pocket. That cost me $800. That was more than my paycheck at the time. So I had rent that I already paid in San Antonio that I'm not going to live at now. I had to pay $800 to ship my car, and I only have 3 nights of a hotel. My car didn't show up for another 5 nights. When my car got there, I didn't have any money to live anywhere. I had to live in my car in the parking lot at Keno Stadium for a week until I got my next paycheck so I can then get a hotel for a couple of days until I could figure out where I'm going to live. It was a tough situation. I lived in my car again when I was in Reno. This is after I've been to the big leagues. I was out of money. I had rent at home in Los Angeles I had to pay. I had bills I had to pay. I couldn't afford rent in Reno. So I slept in my car. I slept in the clubhouse for 5 nights once. I mean, it can be an ugly, ugly deal. So when I say the grind is very, very real, it's real. And, you know, you're away from your family. You're away from the people you care about. And this is not a woe is me story. It's just, it's a very different aspect of life that a lot of people don't see. And it's hard. It's very, very difficult, but it's also can be rewarding. There are moments. I'm very lucky that I got to have moments that no one else in the world will ever get to experience. I loved what I did. I loved playing baseball. I do not love the business of baseball.
Yeah. I mean, I can absolutely see why. I just sort of asking about moving on to a slightly different tack on that is, have attitudes softened? I recently read Dirk Hayhurst's last book of his three books about which is about his sort of his injuries and how he was self-medicating on oxycodone and he had real problems with his mental health and some of his colleagues, he was on the Blue Jays at the time, he sort of ground his nose into the dust around it. I know he was a bit of a character, a bit out there. He wasn't to everyone's cup of tea, but you know, this was 10 years ago. You know, have things changed in the last 10 years? Is it less of a taboo now?
It's less of a taboo now. I will tell you, Dirk, I've known Dirk a long time. Dirk's a really good guy. Yeah, he's very animated. And at the time, yeah, he wasn't everybody's cup of tea. But I feel like if you put Dirk Hayhurst in baseball right now, he fits in perfectly well. Because back then, even when I was playing, you know, when I was making my little YouTube videos that were going viral, like that was very frowned upon back then. They did not like that. Baseball did not like you peeling back the curtain. They did not like you telling stories. They did not want people knowing things. Baseball is probably more scared of that than any other sport. They're just kind of starting to allow the curtain to be pulled back a little. And even that still causes some controversy. You know, you get a guy like Noah Syndergaard putting out one Instagram post and guys are like, oh my God, focus on pitching. Oh my God, shut the fuck up. You think Noah Syndergaard's not focusing on pitching because he posted a shirtless photo? Get out of here.
Yeah, quite so. You just don't like the fact that your wife likes that picture, basically, isn't it?
I mean, he's got some good looking pecs, man.
Well, it's good to hear that attitudes are changing. You know, like we talked a little bit about him earlier on, and we talked about him before we hit record. You know, the way that guys like Tatis can bring it on the big stage surely sort of beats the path. It's all very well for people like Dirk and another guy we've had on here, Tim Dillard, who's another guy.
I know Tim. I played with Tim. Tim's a great guy.
Does this stuff really well, but maybe isn't everyone's cup of tea, right? But if Tatis is out there doing it, it's different gravy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just, you know, people decide what's cool and what's not cool sparingly. You know, Tatis can go out and make a music video. It's perfectly fine. I go out and make a music video. Hey, you should focus on hitting. Yeah. Okay. That being said, I love Tatis. I'm a huge fan. I think the guy is a star. I love what the Padres are doing, man. I'm so excited for the Padres. I played for them for 7 years. I'm as big of a Padre guy as you could ever imagine. I really, really, really excited for him.
Yeah. Well, so Tom, who's one of my co-podcasters, he's like a dog on heat, I think.
It's going to be a fun year.
Yeah, it certainly is. That NL West is just absolutely crazy. If you're not a Padres fan or not a Dodgers fan, I mean, even though the Giants looks like it's going to be a good squad this year, they're going to be a good squad to get 72 wins.
And if I were you, I wouldn't sleep on the Diamondbacks. That offense is as good as any offense in baseball. It's just a matter of whether or not their pitching's going to hold up. I hope it does, because the Diamondbacks could snag one of those wild card spots. The only team that's a loss there is the Rockies. If you're a Rocky fan, root for anyone else. They're never going to win again. Just give up. Give up and move on. Sell all your purple shit. The Titanic is sunk.
Yeah, we have one of those in our hutch as well. So it's all kick him most of the time.
Poor guy. Poor guy. Tough.
Yeah. Yeah, there definitely are not many Rockies fans living in South London. And he's even more on his own now than he has been ever before. Just sort of circling back to your career in the minors, you said earlier on in the conversation that you felt at times as though you deserve more of a shot in the big leagues. I mean, how did you manage to stay resilient through that? And what were the conversations that you were having with? You talked a little bit about the Diamondbacks, but, you know, that was towards the end of your career, where sort of when you were with the Padres and with Kansas City. What conversations, what was stopping you? Was it just sort of bad luck in terms of having a guy blocking you in your position?
I think I just had really bad timing. I was with the Padres for 7 years. I own all their minor league records, and they never called me up until after literally I exhausted my minor league contract. And then even then I didn't play. I got one start. I got like 10 at bats, and they were mostly pinch hit at bats. Not that I don't want to make that sound like I'm complaining. I'm thankful for the Padres for the rest of my life. They gave me the opportunity to be in the big leagues. Then I got a big league experience through them, and I will forever be indebted to the Padres because of it. Unfortunately, I was drafted by them in 2009. That was the Kevin Towers regime. The Kevin Towers regime was fired 1 year later. Then we brought in the Jed Hoyer regime and the McLeod regime. Then they brought in Anthony Rizzo as their first baseman, which means I'm now behind Anthony Rizzo.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to be stuck in the minor leagues behind Anthony Rizzo. And then they left and they traded him. They go over to the Chicago Cubs, and then we brought in Josh Burns, who trades for Yonder Alonso. So, okay, I'm still stuck in the same spot, and Yonder Alonso's got my job for 3 years. Then Josh Burns gets fired, and they promote A.J. Hinch. And A.J. Hinch and I were very close at the time, but he didn't like the job, and he quit. Then he called me the day after he quit and said, I should have called you up. That should have been the last thing I did. My bad. I should have done that. Well, thank you for telling me that 2 days later. I stayed in AAA for another 2 years. Oh, then man. Preller came in, and then I was killing it in 2014. I was told I was going to get called up, and then I was told, nope, Preller's not calling you up. Okay, I go in my next year. So during my time with the San Diego Padres, I had 5 general managers and 3 different owners. And everybody that would come in, I got bumped down the list that much more because I wasn't their guy. I go over to the Royals. You know, I was a couple of people's guy that they were really fighting for me. I was the last guy sent down at spring training. We went and played the last big league game in at Chase Stadium against the Diamondbacks. I was hinted. Pedro Grifol was the catcher's coach, and Pedro is awesome. Pedro Grifol is awesome. Everybody with the Royals is awesome, by the way. What a great organization. Really lovely people. But he kind of hinted to me that morning. He's like, hey, good news coming later. And he kind of went away. And unfortunately, after the game, he comes up. I'm the last one in the clubhouse because I'm the only one that doesn't know where he's going. And I'm the last one in the clubhouse for like an hour. And then finally, Pedro Cafal comes and grabs me, but he doesn't have the smile on his face anymore.
Oh.
And he says, hey, Deck, you got to go talk to Skip. And I just go, fuck! I go in the office. He's like, Decker, I'm sorry. We're not good. We got to send you down to Omaha. We can't make a roster move right now, but we fully intend to see you soon. So I flew with the team to Kansas City. I get to the stadium in Kansas City, and then I got to go to the parking lot and grab my car that they shipped to Kansas City for me and drive to Omaha. That hurt. That sucked. But then I get to Omaha, and then they had a prospect there that they said needed to play first base. So I was going to split time. And I was like, how did I go from making the team to splitting time in AAA? And then they're like, listen, we messed up. We sold you a bad bag of goods. It wasn't because they were being rude or mean or cruel. It was just bad luck. And they just said, listen, we're going to try and do right by you and trade you. I said, I appreciate it, but can't you guys just play me here? I like it here. And unfortunately, I got traded to the Rockies. Was not a good experience, unfortunately. And the Rockies even admitted, my manager even admitted to me, he's like, we rented you. We screwed you. I'm sorry. He's like, Daniel Descalso's hand was broken. The moment Daniel Descalso's hand was no longer broken, you were always getting released, no matter what you were doing. I said, wow. Wow. You know, I had a job over with Kansas City, and now I'm going home without a job. That's ridiculous. I was really, I thought that was the ugliest thing to do to anybody. It was almost cruel on how the Rockies handled it. I was really, it was awful. A month and a half goes by and I end up signing with the Red Sox. It just depends on where you are. You got to be somebody's guy. I hate to say this, but baseball is very much about who you know. I was a 22nd rounder. I got paid $638.43 after taxes. There was no financial investment in me. If there's not a financial investment in you, you got to hit like crazy to get to the big leagues. You got to pitch like a madman to get to the big leagues. Because in the history of Major League Baseball, there hasn't even been 20,000 players to ever make it to the major leagues for one at bat or one pitch. That fills up a third of Dodger Stadium. Just for a little bit of, you know, context, a third of Dodger Stadium filled to the brim would be the amount of players that ever spent 1 second in the big leagues. And we're talking nearly 200 years of Major League Baseball. So it's hard. It's a tough business. And, you know, that's only reason I ever get mad at fans when they start going like, oh, a bunch of millionaires. There are not very many millionaires in the big leagues. You hear about the millionaires, but there are not very many of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing, I saw you mention this the other day, and it's something that sort of dwelled on my mind when I knew we were going to have this conversation, was it always struck me that, you know, a guy like you, power hitting corner outfielder, is exactly the type of profile that might have had interest from Japan and Korea. But it never, and you did, you know, I saw you saying the Bay Stars were sniffing around you at one time, but it never quite stuck. It just struck me that you would be exactly what they were looking for. How come it never worked out?
One of my biggest regrets is I never got to play in Japan. I always, this is crazy. My dream was always to play in Japan. I always wanted to play in Japan. My favorite baseball movie is The Natural.
Yeah.
Mr. Baseball, Bull Durham. Nice. And Mr. Baseball is a real sneaky one. Tom Selleck might have had the best swing in the history of baseball movies. Nice. I got to say, every time I saw Jack Elliott over in Japan, I'm like, I want to do that. That looks awesome. I just never got the opportunity, unfortunately. When I was with the Rockies, that's when Yokohama was coming around. They were scouting me. They were watching me. They came to a game once. I was facing Paxton, who was with the Mariners at the time. I homered off Paxton, and I'm like, well, that's going to seal the deal. Like, Paxton's this huge prospect. I just homered off them. I'll have an offer on the table in 2 days. And then I got released by the Rockies. And the thing about teams in Asia, if you are a free agent, they don't want you.
Yeah.
Even though it's cheaper for them to get you, they would rather pay an organization $150,000 to $200,000 to speak to you rather than nothing. Because it's a weird perception thing. They're like, well, if you're not playing in the States, why would we come get you? And I'm like, well, now it's going to cost you way less. Why don't you just sign me now? Like, we're not interested anymore. We're going to sign this guy. So it didn't work out with Yokohama because the Rockies released me. That was part of the reason. Other times I spoke to Korea. There was a time where I was talking with Doosan Bears at one point. When I played in the WBC in Korea, I spoke to a couple of teams while I was there. I would have loved to have played in Korea. I loved playing in Seoul in the WBC, and I got the opportunity to play at the Tokyo Dome in Japan, which was just amazing. My only regret in baseball is that I never got to play a full year in Japan or a full year in the KBO. I would have loved it. It would have been a dream come true for me.
So that seems like a good point to sort of switch lanes and talk a little bit about your time with the Israel squad. But before we come on to that in general, and you alluded to this earlier, you were sort of talking about the potential neurosis of being a Jewish baseball player. What was it like to be a Jewish baseball player in a sport that's such a sort of huge majority of the players are Christian, but not just Christian, but like really sort of like quite into church, into faith? How was that for you? Was it something that ever dwelled on your mind, or was it just, you know, you went with the flow?
I grew up in Santa Monica, California, and it's a very Jewish community. You know, but they were the same type of Jewish people that I was. You know, we celebrated the holidays, but we also celebrate Christmas. We celebrate Easter while we're celebrating Passover. It's like it's more of a very relaxed existence in Santa Monica as a Jewish person. And I didn't realize how weird that was to other people until I left Santa Monica, until I played professional baseball. And when some people would find out I was Jewish, you would have thought I literally spit in their face. I'm like, what's the problem? It makes no sense. It made no sense to me. I only dealt with a couple of things. I dealt with a couple of really weird interactions, specifically with the Rockies. I can't stress enough, the Rockies, my time with the Rockies is the worst experience I ever had in professional baseball. I had a moment
they are known for being particularly Christian, right?
You know, I got called into the office to have a meeting with somebody at the Rockies. I'm not going to say who, but he's like, I didn't know you were Jewish. Come sit down with me. And he wanted to talk to me about religion. And I just really didn't want to do this. And he's like, well, I'm born again Christian. This is what I believe. What do you believe? I said, can I leave, please? This is awful. I don't want to talk to anybody about this. And he just insisted. And we ended up talking for a half hour and I was released 2 days later. I don't know if that's why I was released, but it sure as shit pissed me off. Again, did not like my time with the Rockies.
Yeah, you've made that.
Did not like my time with the Rockies. Very obvious. I cannot stress enough. The Rockies were the worst.
I'm just going to, before I even edit this, I'm just going to send the unexpurgated version directly into Ben's ears. Just listen to this. You'll never buy anything purple ever again.
Oh, God. I don't have enough. I don't have anything good to say about my time there, except I loved my manager in AAA. I really, really, really loved him. I thought he was a great guy. I had a good coaching staff in AAA and I had good teammates too. And really impressive ball players. I remember one guy that stood out on that team in Albuquerque was Michael Tauchman, who's with the Yankees. And I really think that guy is so unbearably talented. And I really hope the Yankees give him a legitimate shot because they're a better team if they just play him. He is that good. And no one knows it yet. And I can't believe no one knows it yet because he's that good. Guy just hits, just figures out a way to hit. It's just I'm sorry. I feel like I've gone off on a tangent that I don't know.
That's absolutely right. Well, let's.
About being Jewish. Well, it was never really that big of a problem. I remember one time I had a chaplain because there's Sunday chapel at every clubhouse.
Exactly.
But I have yet to be at any of the Saturday synagogues, but because they don't exist. Only one time I had a bad experience was a chaplain one time wouldn't leave me alone. He's like, well, why don't you come to chapel? I'm like, I'm good. He's like, I'm Jewish, so I'm good. And he's like, well, it's for all denominations. I'm like, are you reading the New Testament? He said, yeah. No, it's not. Also, I don't want to go. Just please leave me alone. And he wouldn't stop pestering me for 30 minutes. My manager had to come over. I'm like, hey, can you leave him alone? That was really the only time. But I had other experiences as well. I remember... if you see the movie Heading Home, The Tale of Team Israel, if it's available on Amazon Prime, I tell a story about one time in spring training when I was with the Padres. It was like my second spring training. I met up with a bunch of my teammates in a town in Glendale called Westgate. I met them up with a bar, just guys hanging out, excited to see each other again. And we all sit down and there was these, we were all young, single guys out of college. And there was this group of girls that sat at our table and somebody made some Jewish joke towards me. But it's a close friend of mine. I don't care if you joke with me about it. You'd go all day. But then one girl was sickened the fact that I was Jewish, to which I was like, it's your problem. And she insisted that I have to leave the table or else the girls should leave. And my teammates were like, bye, you guys can go. I always appreciated my teammates doing that. I think the teammates specifically that really told them off was Blake Ducote, Alan Dykstra, Cole Figueroa, and one other guy. They just had my back. They were like, I can't, no. How dare you say, and they were really cool about it. I had great teammates. I was a very lucky guy when it came to teammates in my career. I just had the best guys I got to play with.
So you talked about heading for home there. So let's talk a bit about that experience playing with the Israeli national team in the World Baseball Classic, where you vanquished the plucky Great Britain Bahamas co-squad in Brooklyn, and then took it over to Seoul to play in the World Baseball Classic and qualified for the final. So how did that come about? How did you first hear about this idea that there was going to be this sort of super squad of sort of expatriates, so Jewish people, Jewish Americans who were going to play for the Israeli team? We've had a couple of your teammates. So Ty Kelly's been on, Nate Fryman. Great everyone guys. Speaks incredibly highly of what an amazing experience it was.
It was. Ty Kelly is a wonderful guy. Nate Freiman might be one of my all-time favorite teammates. Me and Nate play together. Sorry, Nate and I have a friend of mine who's a grammar friend. He would be furious with me. Nate and I played together with the Padre organization. Then we played together again with the Red Sox organization. So we were very close. So getting a chance to play with Nate for a fifth time was the best. The experience was great. There was aspects of it that were just you'll never get to have that experience again. That's for sure. How did I first hear about it? It was 2011. I heard rumblings about the next WBC that they were thinking about having an Israeli team. And I was like, well, man, I don't know how many Jews are even in baseball, but I heard rumblings that Brad Ausmus would be the manager for the qualifier. And Brad was an executive for the Padres at the time. So I immediately sent him a text. I'm like, hey man, you know, I'm Jewish, right? He's like, yes, you're my four hitter. I already decided that a week ago. I said, oh, okay. Well, thanks for telling me. And it was great. We played in the qualifier. We were the best team in the qualifier, and it was a double, and it never sat well with us because it was a double elimination tournament, but it turned out it was a modified double elimination tournament. We didn't really know that until the final game. Mm. We beat Spain quite handedly. We beat South Africa quite handedly. And then we go to the championship against Spain, a team we already beat. But since they went through the loser's bracket, which really meant they won two games, it just gets reverted to 0-0. So it's a winner take all game. And we ended up losing that game in like the 12th inning in extra innings on a fluke thing that, and I never sat well with any of us. Any of us were like 99 out of 100, we beat them. Like, this is a freak thing. And they're going to go play in the World Baseball Classic. It drove us nuts. So a couple of years later, they reached out to me and asked me if I would do it again. At the time I was not interested because it was my time with the Red Sox, and I was very despondent about baseball, and I felt like I wanted to hang them up at the time. I was like, this isn't fun anymore. And Nate was on my team, and Nate was kind of in a similar spot as me, and we started talking with each other like, let's just do it. We have unfinished business, let's go do it. We finally did it, and we went out, and our time in Brooklyn was the most fun I had ever had playing baseball. I was in heaven playing in that qualifier, and I played great. I felt like me again. You know, we were playing pranks. I was just having fun. I got us a mensch on the bench that we got to put in the club, in the dugout. And we just made a mockery of just about everything. And then we just boat raced everybody.
and
we just had a blast. And I remember after we won the qualifier, I got a phone call from that same executive from the Red Sox. And he just said, he's like, I told you were you. And I was just like, you're the man. Nice. Dude. You're the man. I had a really good tournament, and I was playing third. I was playing a good third base. And I'll never forget that our bench coach pulled me aside. He's like, Deck, you could actually play third. I'm like, I know. I always could. Just never let me. He's like, man, we had a scout when we were, because he used to be an executive for the Padres. And he's just like, Deck, I'm telling you, our scouting report on you was that you had the range of a cigar store Indian. I was like, well, he's like, we got to change that scouting report. Well, I'm in my 30s, so it's a little late, Dick.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, it was even as someone with a rooting interest in that tournament, you know, because there was a GB team out there hustling. It was so fun. Like, you know, we were watching those games, and obviously we wanted GB to beat you, although it would have been a similar scale of injustice given that you'd already beaten them. But yeah, I mean, you could tell you guys were having a whole lot of fun. That whole tournament just seemed a lot of fun.
Like, oh man, I'm telling you, that qualifier in Brooklyn, if you were there, you saw something special. Like, when you get a team together, it's never special. It's a team. It's a guys that are gonna grind it out. That, for whatever reason, I don't know if it was because we were all Jewish and it was something that was like just something that bonded us underneath it all. I don't know if that's what it was. It might have something to do with it. I think more it was the group of guys just happened to be Jewish, but we were a bunch of guys that all felt like we had something to prove. Mm. It was me. It was Nate Freiman. It was Ryan LaVarnway. It was all these guys that tasted the major leagues, but were all told we weren't good enough to stay there. And I'm like, yeah, we are. We are definitely good enough to stay there, and we'll show you. And then we got in the tournament, and I remember, I'll never forget. And again, if you watch the Tale of Team Israel, it's on Amazon Prime. It's a very fun movie, because the movie, I believe, was started as one thing. I think they had this idea, like, we're going to get all these Jewish baseball players and have them refine their Judaism. Not what happened. Okay. Not what happened at all. What happened was, we were just a bunch of American Jewish players who all felt like we'd been in a way, kicked to the side, disrespected our whole careers, and we were going to prove somebody. It turns into this great baseball story because we get to the tournament in Korea, and we were 200-1 to win. And I'll never forget ESPN referred to us as a bunch of wannabes and nobodies, to which I just said, you know, we're going to kick the shit out of all of you, right? You know how much better we are than you?
Loads of us played in the majors.
Like, I'm just sitting here. I'm like, I'm looking through our lineup 1-9. I'm like, there's 1,000 home runs there. You guys are, me and Ryan looked at each other. I'm like, these guys are fucked and they don't know it. Can't wait. Cannot wait. And I remember we won game one and everyone's like, oh, underdogs. We mean underdogs. We're going to win. We go and we play the Netherlands. We beat their ass. We go and we play Cuba. We beat their ass. We go and we play, who else? Chinese Taipei. We beat them by 30. We're just like, dude, what is wrong with you guys? We knew how good we were. Why don't you? And, you know, and all of a sudden when we beat Cuba, the narrative all of a sudden changed. A week ago, we were wannabes and losers. We didn't have any business being here. Now they're trying to say, oh, you're just an American B team. What? You think any of us could ever sniff the U.S. team? There's five guys with $100 million contracts. All of us get paid $1.50. Like, we're better. And they didn't know it. And it was so gratifying to beat up on the stars because, you know, if you can be successful in AA, if you're a good AA player, you can be successful in the big leagues. 100%. No question about it. If you can get outs in AA, you can get outs in the big leagues. If you hit in the AA, you can hit in the big leagues. The end. The competition is not the staggering difference that you think it is. It's not. It's just opportunity that is very hard to come by because there's 25 men on that big league roster and they're not going anywhere. Where are they going? Look at any roster that you root for. That 25-man roster that you're excited about, which one of those guys do you want gone? Well, two of them might not be on the roster at the end of the year, and then you got two new guys. There's 25 men in AAA just waiting for a shot. You need somebody to get hurt or to play terribly, which is awful because you're in a position that you're like, you got to root against people that you're honestly friends with. So it's a tough dog-eat-dog world in this game.
I always thought that was ridiculous, though. You know, like, as you said, you know, you had two guys on that roster who were 2013 World Series champions in Ryan Levanway and Craig Breslow. Jason Marquis pitched, what, 300 games in the majors.
In case you don't know this about Jason Marquis, Jason Marquis' nickname, I don't know if it was a popular nickname, but his nickname was the Golden Jew. And the reason he was called the Golden Jew is because if you had Jason Marquis on your team, you were going to playoffs. Because Jason Marquis at that point had been like 13 straight playoffs.
I think I have heard that before. I think Jake Mintz from Cessna's Barbecue is a good friend of ours. I'm sure I've heard him mention that before. Because
the first time I ever heard it, when I was with playing for the Padres, and we signed him, but he was rehabbing an injury. I don't remember his shoulder or elbow. And somebody just said, "Hey, Deck, you're not alone. We got the Golden Jew. We're going to the playoffs."
That's amazing. Yeah, the two stories that our now former national team coach Liam, who's a good friend of ours, likes to tell is the story of the starters in that double elimination tournament final in Brooklyn was Jason, the Golden Jew going to the playoffs, and the GB starter was a school teacher, that's what the World Baseball Classic is, and he pitched 4.1 scoreless innings.
He actually pitched great. I don't remember what he did to me. I know he hit me. Thanks for doing that. I homered later in the game. But yeah, I remember I got hit by a pitch early.
And the other story that Liam always tells is that he was a field coach at UNLV where one of his players was Blake Galen, and every time he faces Blake, he hits a homer. There's no love lost between those two guys now.
Blake's a lovely guy. I love Blake. Yeah.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about baseball. You said you didn't want to talk about baseball. We've talked about baseball for an hour. Let's talk about some cool stuff. So
let's do it.
We set this up off the back of you talking about Oasis. So let's start there. Tell us about your Oasis fandom. So I'm here in Manchester right now, a mile away.
Lovely.
From Sifters Records.
I'm going to make this abundantly clear. I am Team Liam all the way.
Oh, yeah.
Love me some Liam Gallagher. Noel. Listen, Liam's insane, but you got to love his insanity.
Oh yeah.
Noel is the talent. We all know that Noel is the talented one, quote unquote. He's the one that writes all the music, but man, does he put you to sleep when he sings a song. Every time I listen to every song I hear sung by Noel, I'm like, God, this is a great song. Imagine if Liam was singing it.
Don't look back in anger. Well, I am, because you're singing it. Right?
Oh God, so you're putting me to sleep with this song, and Liam would keep me awake. That's why Oasis Unplugged is the greatest album of all time, because it just exposes how not great Noel is.
Okay, right. So I think I could probably take a wild swing at these. It's not going to be Don't Look Back in Anger for a start. But what are your top three Oasis tracks then?
Oh man, that is not an easy thing to ask. Let's start with albums. You know what? They had an album, and I told this story recently. I actually told it on Twitter with you. This is a true story. My favorite album by them used to be Morning Glory, obviously. What's the story? Morning Glory. But the album Don't Believe the Truth is so good. It's song 1 through 12, perfection. Just everything about it. That album and what is the name of that other album that I just can't get enough of?
It's Definitely Maybe. It's the first one. Is it that
one? Not Definitely Maybe, because really that only had one song on it that I love, and that's, you know, Supersonic. I mean, it's just because it's a catchy song, but you can clearly tell that they're still new to this. They're not Oasis yet. They're not there yet. But every time I hear the song What's the Story, Morning Glory, is just like, oh, okay, that's where Oasis is. And I even like Be Here Now, because I love Do You Know What I Mean? It used to be my walkout song. I always thought that was the coolest song.
That is a good tune. Here. That's so underrated.
But you know what? I'm going to start with that. Number one Oasis song, Do You Know What I Mean? Off the first song off the album, Be Here Now. I love that song. There's something about that chorus that just gets me going. And honestly, my sophomore year of high school, I led the state of California in home runs. And I remember when I first started going off, I went to a play against a team called Oaks Christian. They're in the Valley in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I remember on the drive out, I was listening to the album Be Here Now. And I was listening to the song, Do You Know What I Mean? And I ended up going back and playing it like four more times. And then I went straight on the field and played. I went 6 for 6 with 2 home runs, 2 triples and 2 doubles. Mm-hmm. And I've been like, well, I'm listening to that song every day before every game now. And it became my routine that I would listen to that song. And then new songs started kind of coming in. And then I would always listen to the same music before every game. So Do You Know What I Mean? It's probably number one. I think I have to blame the movie Snatch for this, even though the song has no lyrics. But how can you not love the song Fucking in the Bushes? That is
that's a tune.
that riff is just if you're walking along the street and that song pops on, you're fired up.
Yeah, you're strutting, aren't you, right away?
Every single time. That's got to be somewhere. If it's not in the top three, it's close. What's the Story, Morning Glory, I think, is one of their best songs. And then I got a sneaky one here, and it's between two songs. And I can't believe I'm saying it, because one of them is sung by Noel.
Oh, yeah.
The song She Is Love is a great song.
Right.
Acoustic jam. But again, every time I hear it, I'm like, God, I love this song. Imagine if Liam was singing it. Probably so much better. And then Songbird.
Lovely.
Song that I don't know why. There's something about that song that just... talking to the songbird yesterday, flew me far away, not far away. Yeah, I love it.
That is a good one, for
the
sure.
The only thing that upsets me is the final album by Oasis is literally just trash. Dig Up Your Soul is horrible.
They didn't want to be there by then, did they?
No, it was very clear that they phoned that was just B-sides from albums they'd never put on other albums. I hated that album. But it's funny we got into talking about this, because I missed out on seeing Oasis for the Don't Believe the Truth tour. And, you know, we were even joking. My buddy and I, we were driving to the Hollywood Bowl. We're so excited. And we were starting to speculate. We started making bets with each other. I'm like, what song do they open up with? And I'm like, I bet they open up with this. I'm like, no. Don't Believe the Truth is out. And the first song is Turn Up the Sun. You know they're starting with Turn Up the Sun. and then we never found out, because we were a day late.
Oh man. Goodness.
I missed that concert. Yeah. I'm an enormous Oasis. Honestly, I hope they get back together. I'm picking on Noel a little bit too much, because I do like some of Noel's solo work. But man, oh man, I would give anything to see Oasis in concert. And I don't care how it happens. I don't care if they play one song and then they start a fist fight. That'd be probably even a better concert than them playing their whole catalog.
Yeah, I mean, I have seen them, and it's but it's a long time ago. I'm trying to think of which album it was that they were touring. So it was the one which started. The first song was the Hindu Times. I can't remember the name of that
Yes.
album.
I'm trying to remember that name of that album too. I'm just gonna look it up. I'm tired of the because that has She Is Love,
Yeah.
that has Songbird. That album is truly a jam.
Yeah.
Oasis. I'm here. This is what I'm doing. I'm just pulling out my phone. That's what I'm doing.
There you go.
Oasis.
Just riff.
Why Heathen Chemistry. God,
That's
that
the
was why
one.
couldn't I remember the title of that album?
Yeah.
Yeah, Heathen Chemistry. And you know what's another album of theirs that's never talked about? The Master Plan. That
Oh
is
yeah.
such a good album. Just you can listen to everything on there.
Oh, that is a real cracker. That's got some absolutely awesome. They're all B-sides, aren't they? It's ridiculous. When, you
Yeah.
know, what, at that time when Noel Gallagher was writing those as B-sides, that's just absolutely crackers, wasn't
Insane.
it?
Listen, I'm making fun of Noel a little bit too much. He's a hell of a songwriter and a great musician, but he's just so much better when Liam's there.
Yeah, I one of my recent regrets in terms of seeing music was Liam played a solo show in so we live in Manchester, a solo show in a small venue here, and I got an alert through on one of the ticket apps I have on my phone, and by the time I'd sort of texted my girlfriend and was like, should we go to this? It's today. It had sold out. You know, of course, I should have just got the tickets and gone, man. I don't know what I was doing. Like, it was a 600 capacity venue. It would have been amazing.
And his solo stuff's not bad. Wall of Glass and Chinatown are a couple of really good songs, man. It's
Yeah,
and
I
it
like
and
it.
it sounds like some old school Oasis made me go like, man, Noel, Liam's coming for you.
He definitely is. He definitely is. Yeah. He also, by the way, because I have seen him, he is tiny, which really, really surprised me. I walked past it. So there's a bit of a thing, like particularly here in Manchester, a lot of people dress like they're in Oasis, and I sort of for a time it's like, look at this guy, looks like he thinks he's in Oasis to my girlfriend, and it was a bit of a running joke. And then I once did it, and it was literally Liam Gallagher, and she was like, "That's Liam Gallagher." I was like, "He's so small." So yeah.
I never would have guessed that. He always seems so much
Well,
taller than his
exactly. You
brother.
think he's got this amazing, like, big personality and huge
Yeah.
presence? No, he's a little dude. I'm only like 5 foot 9, and I had maybe a couple of inches on him.
Who knew? Wow, I didn't know
Yeah.
that. I always thought he was a taller dude.
Yeah. So another big British export that you're a big fan of is Doctor Who, which you revealed this one to me only very recently. So
I am
who?
an enormous, I'm not kind of a Doctor Who fan. I am a Whovian to the nth degree, to the point that my wife is now a Whovian. Like
Amazing.
I was there opening night when at the 50th anniversary at the theaters. I was dressed up as David Tennant. I built a TARDIS for Halloween one year that was on wheels that I would jump out of dressed as a different doctor each night. I am a huge Doctor Who fan. Huge Doctor Who fan.
Wow, that's absolutely incredible. So I was going to ask you, who's your doctor? But I think you've given it away. If
It's
you were
not
dressed as
Tennant.
Tennant,
It
it's not Tennant.
used to be Tennant. I'm a huge Tennant. I think every new Who doctor was amazing.
Jodie Whittaker.
Huh?
Jodie
Oh, I like
Whittaker?
Jodie Whittaker. I
Yeah.
think she. I like her a lot. I just think the writing. I think Chris Chibnall is not the best showrunner, in my opinion. He's not. It's not horrible, but it's more like, can we go back and pretend the Timeless Child didn't happen? Can we just go back?
Yeah.
Let's fix that. Let's fix that
Yeah.
right now. But no, I really like Jodie Whittaker. I all I keep thinking is, oh man, I wish Moffat was writing her. I bet she'd have some greater lines, and I bet a little bit better story arcs. But honestly, I love Peter Capaldi so much as the Doctor. I thought he brought a gravitas that no other Doctor had. It felt a little Tom Baker-ish with a little bit of David Tennant. Like he felt alien. Wise and his final season when he was doing teaching at the school as a professor had me enthralled. Every speech he gave me going like, my God, this is what it is. This is the doctor I want to see forever. The speeches he would give, I remember there was one episode where he talks about he was the only doctor that would break the fourth wall and talk to the audience. I remember he was explaining the bootstrap paradox to the audience, and I'm like, please open every episode like this from now on. Just, I want Peter Capaldi to speak to me and teach me things. I
Yeah.
love this.
There was it sort of took a little bit of time for them to get the dynamic right. I always felt with we could just talk about this forever. I always felt with the Peter Capaldi Doctor when they brought in Nardole, it just seemed to work better. Like that
The
chemistry that they
moment
had
Nardole
was.
showed up, I was like, my God, this is, I need five more seasons of this. And I absolutely loved Billy. I thought she was great. I just, man, they had, that was a cool season. And I just thought Peter Capaldi brought a gravitas to it that I hadn't seen in a while. And I love Tennant because I felt like Tennant played that lonely God character so well. He was just so sympathetic, and he was filled with regret. There was just something about it that you couldn't touch. And then, you went in a kind of slightly different direction with Matt Smith, and I thought Matt Smith was fantastic. I thought
I
it was
love,
charming and
so
fun.
Matt Smith is my favorite. I
See,
love
Matt
him.
Smith, I think, had the benefit of having the best Doctor Who season of all time. And his first season, the fifth series, is just, it's an untouchable season from start to finish. What a story arc. Everything about it is perfection. And you can't sit here and pretend that Amy and Rory aren't the best companions in the
Yeah,
Doctor
they're
Who's
amazing.
entire echelon. I can't get enough of Doctor. Even the bad episodes. Like, I could sit down and watch, what was that one Capaldi episode where the world was covered in trees?
Oh, yeah.
It's the single worst hour of television I've ever watched. It's unwatchable. I could watch that right now and be happy, even though it's unwatchable. That's how much I love Doctor Who, that I could sit here and justify the worst of it, the worst of it.
That really is quite something. Yeah, you with me, just the Matt Smith thing. I always felt that for a guy who was like, what, he was like 22 when he first started playing that, he looked like he was 6 million years old. There was
He felt
something in his
ancient.
there was something in like this very young man that just felt ancient. And I don't know what how he did that.
And
But
if there's any,
I also thought he was
oh, go ahead.
amazing in The Crown, so he's obviously just a good actor.
He's an amazing actor. And but the reason why, to me, Doctor Who is just the best show of all time. When they brought the show back, and you never watched old Doctor Who original series, the way that the first showrunner that was there, Russell T. Davies,
Russell T.
the way
Davies, yeah.
Russell T. Davies spoon-fed you 40 years worth of backstory for that first season is almost, it's a masterstroke of storytelling. You walk into that first season not knowing anything about Doctor Who, and you will know everything about Doctor Who by the end of that first series. And then the end of that first series, you get David Tennant. So there's just an added treat to the whole thing. It's just, it's unbelievable what they were able to do that show. And the culmination to the 50th anniversary is, to me, the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who is probably the greatest television accomplishment, in my opinion, of all time. The fact that you were able to tell a cohesive story, the fact that you were able to create and pay off so much lore while giving me David Tennant, Matt Smith, and John Hurt. I was a kid in a candy store. It was just every, there was not a moment that I wasn't with popcorn. The best.
Yeah, that was
Oh,
so
and then
good.
the slight introduction of Peter Capaldi's eyes, I think I lost my mind. I never, when you're in a theater with a bunch of Whovians and you hear that cheering, no, sir, all 13, and all you saw was Peter Capaldi's eyes. All I'm like, oh my God, next year's gonna be amazing. Next year's gonna be amazing. Peter Capaldi looks pissed.
He permanently looks pissed in like every role that he's done for the last 30 years, I think. So he was yeah, he was the right guy to bring in at that time for sure.
Yeah, so I'm just I'm a huge Doctor Who, basically almost everything. I mean, Luther is one of my favorite shows.
Oh yeah.
I've not been quiet about how much I love Top Gear to the Grand Tour. Not current Top Gear, obviously. I'm a big car fan, but let's be real clear. You don't watch Top Gear for the cars. You watch it because you love Clarkson, May, and Hammond.
Yeah,
And
you're not here for Paddy McGuinness and Andrew Flintoff.
I'm sorry. They seem like very lovely men, but I don't care.
Andrew Flintoff is very good at cricket, but I'm not quite sure what he's doing on Top Gear.
Yeah, I'm sorry, man. I watch for Clarkson, Hammond, and May. That's why I watch the show, because I can't get enough of them. They're just perfect together.
They certainly do have incredible chemistry for sure.
So Top Gear and the Grand Tour is kind of my comfort food. If I can't find something to watch, I just throw on old Top Gear, and I just sit back and just enjoy myself.
Do you get the cultural references that they have in there? Does it if you're into Doctor Who and you're into Oasis, you must get some of it, but some of it is pretty niche, if I recall correctly, because I haven't seen the Grand Tour, but watching some of those old episodes of Top Gear when they're wheeling, celebrities out to do the star in the reasonably priced car, you're just like, who the hell is this?
No, it helps that I've watched a lot of
Right.
BBC. That helps. It's, and I will admit there is an occasional thing where they bring in somebody. I'm like, oh shit, I don't know who that is. But it's a good enough interview that I enjoy myself. But it's the only time I'm lost is when they bring in like newscasters that are popular in the area. Because obviously I don't see your newscasters. I have no idea who they are. I always kind of felt the same thing. I'm like, I wonder, like when they had like Jay Leno on, because Jay Leno is a huge, like, do they know, are they feeling how I feel when they bring out like the nightly news guy? Like, are they watching Jay Leno? Like, who the fuck is this guy? Like, Jay Leno was a big deal here, but is he a big deal in London? I mean, do
I
you
think
guys know what the Tonight Show is?
people know who he is. But
Yeah, but
yeah,
like,
and I think the things that people know about Jay Leno in the UK is he has a big chin and he likes cars. That's about
that's, I'm not gonna lie to you, that's it. That's
it.
it.
That's his whole personality
That's all he's
encapsulated.
got. He told occasional jokes. I hated the Tonight Show when he hosted it.
And the other thing that you're a huge fan of, and I know you've been having a go at it this week, and indeed we're doing a watch along of the WWE Elimination Chamber is professional wrestling as well, right?
I was a huge wrestling fan my whole life. I have a lot of friends in the industry. My wife obviously has worked in the industry. She's worked for WWE, AEW, and at NWA. I've done some stuff with the WWE over the years, especially while I was playing. When I was with the Diamondbacks, I did a thing. I was basically the Diamondbacks correspondent of the Royal Rumble in
Nice.
2019.
I remember
When, yeah, it
that.
was a blast. They just called me and like, hey, you want to come and do all these things? I said, well, obviously, but I'm like, I'm not on the big league team right now, right? And they're like, we don't care. We know you're who else we're gonna ask. I'm like, good point. Well, let's go do it. And I had a blast. I did a lot of cool stuff that weekend, spent a lot of time with Daniel Bryan. And this was during my favorite Daniel Bryan of all time, the environmentally friendly Daniel
Oh,
Bryan,
yeah.
who somehow is a villain only because he wants you to recycle.
Yeah,
Go
that was
figure.
such
America, man. That's just America, man.
exactly.
This guy, oh, this guy wants us to recycle and take care of the planet? Fuck him. He's like the only good guy on TV. I can't get it. I love, I still love, but I, as I mentioned to you before, I fall in and out of love with wrestling fast. Like it fast. I can watch wrestling nonstop for a week and then I'm done for 6 months. I'm like, okay, that's it. That was bad enough to cut me off for a while. And then something good will happen, I'll come back in. Like if I ever find out CM Punk is wrestling, obviously I'll probably tune into that. And Phil's an awesome guy. I really get along with him. He's cool.
I'm a bit the same as you. Like it's like popcorn to me. Like I can have a load of it and then I'll feel bloated and I don't want any for ages.
Yeah,
And there are some things that I just can't zone into. So some of the more wacky end of stuff that WWE are doing, that the Fiend, not for me. Like I know
Oh,
it's not for
really?
me.
Oh, I love. See,
Do you?
I normally would totally agree with you, with the exception of the Fiend, because I every time I see Firefly Funhouse, I'm like, all right, guys, everybody stop. I gotta watch this because this is just demented, twisted, and I don't understand how it even got on TV, but it's per I have to watch it.
I'm here for some pretty crazy stuff. I don't mind carny acts, but
See,
that's kind
I
of
actually
over the line for
really
me.
I hate carny acts. I hate them. 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 But I can watch NXT all day. Like, I think NXT is the single best wrestling to watch, storytelling wise, wrestling wise, talent wise. And that's not the same thing about like SmackDown Raw. Like, Cesaro is, I think, the best wrestler in the world right now.
He's amazing.
I would give anything to watch more of Cesaro and Big E. I can watch Daniel Bryan and AJ Styles any day, anytime, any day, and be thrilled. Kofi Kingston still can do things that no one else can do. But man, give me some Johnny Gargano and Ciampa anytime.
Well,
Anytime.
that Elimination Chamber on Sunday, which was Baron Corbin and a bunch of Ring of Honor workers, was
Yeah, that part, right?
By Daniel Bryan.
Yeah, right. And I gotta say, I was on so I was on, you know, the Elimination Chamber watch along for WWE, and I asked a question to Mark Henry. I was there on there with Mark Henry, and I said, hey, I don't know about you guys, but I got some serious Kofi Kingston feelings from 2 years ago watching Cesaro in this Elimination Chamber. Yeah, I know he didn't win, but that was the Cesaro show. And I loved every second of the Cesaro show. I just want them to give him every title, and including the tag titles for himself, and maybe even one of the women's titles. I don't know. I just think he should be covered in gold. I can't get enough of Cesaro. I think he's so much fun.
Yeah, he certainly is. I'm with you on NXT. I've got to say that's where I would place my chips if I were
any, watching anytime. All the time. It, like, you know, because I'll skip a Raw or I'll skip a SmackDown, but I don't like missing very much NXT. I just think it's good and simple storytelling, but it's always long term. It's never like, you know, I think WWE always, because it's episodic, they always get into the short term, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, things move quick, but I really like how NXT kind of takes its time to tell some stories. And whenever WWE decides to take their time with stories, I'm happier than can be. I'm like, oh, I feel like I'm being rewarded by watching your product type thing. You know, that, like when Kofi Kingston won the World Heavyweight Championship at WrestleMania 2 years ago, that was perfection. Like I almost had a tear go down my face going like, I've been rewarded by sticking with this for so long. Thank you. And same thing I felt about Daniel Bryan 3 years before that, when Daniel Bryan won the title. I'm like, I finally, I have been rewarded by watching this show for 25 years. This is the moment I've waited for. Is WWE over? Is this the final scene? Because you could end now and I'd be happy.
I think the final scene for me is when Zach Gibson is on top as a singles guy, and he's still doing the "I am Liverpool's number one Zach Gibson" gimmick.
Tell me if I'm wrong. I have not been able to watch enough of the Champions League right now. Is Liverpool still in? They have a game on Sunday, right?
Yeah, Liverpool is still in.
Yeah, I got scared there because there was a whole thing. I know you're in Manchester, so you're probably a Man City or Manchester United
fan. Oh, no, I have no rooting interest in that. It's my team plays in the lower leagues of English football. They're rubbish, so don't worry. You're not going to offend me.
Yeah. I don't know why I root for Liverpool. I think it's just because Tomorrow Never Knows is my favorite song of all time by the Beatles. Last song on Rubber Soul, fun fact. Or is it Rubber Soul or is it? No, it's not Rubber Soul. It's but what's the other one? What's the other really good album that no one talks about by the Beatles?
The White Album.
Nope, not the White. Everybody talks about the White Album.
Let It Be.
Revolver. Revolver. Last song on Revolver. I love Revolver. I feel like that's an underrated Beatles album. I always root for Liverpool. Not sure why. Just my whole life, I like watching Liverpool.
They're still in the Champions League, but they're struggling a bit in the Premier League this year. They're not. They've got a lot of injuries, so they're not. I was talking to my old, I used to work in Liverpool. I was talking to my old team over there earlier this week, and I was kind of rubbing it in their face a little bit, but I made it better because I can see Old Trafford out of my office where I work. I showed them a picture of that with me doing an unfriendly gesture towards Manchester United, so shall we say. They enjoyed that.
Is it the British two fingers thing, or is it the middle? Why the two fingers? That's the only thing I've never known. Why two fingers? You know, we have the middle finger over here. Yep. Why two fingers over there? To me, that just seems like a lovely peace sign.
Yeah. Well, it's, I don't know. And, you know, you see pictures of Winston Churchill doing that. I think it's the two fingers is sort of metaphorically to the Germans, because that's what Churchill did. That would be typically British. You know, we're just never not offending Germany. So it's it's how we live our lives. I don't know, actually. I'm guessing.
I've never known. I've been always, every time I was watching Ted Lasso a month ago and going like, everyone keeps throwing the two fingers thing. I've never understood what that was.
Yeah, they do the middle finger as well. But yeah, there's something sort of slightly daft about the two fingers. I think that's why people, it never seems particularly offensive. It's always done with a smirk.
And can I also ask a separate question? This is another thing that's always bugged me about the UK, and it's never been very clear to me. When they talk about the North, Northerners in England, why is that North? Why isn't Scotland North?
Oh, right. So that's a good question. I'm the right person to ask, right? So I'm
Yeah,
where
because
I'm
you're
from.
Manchester, so you're northern, but why are you northern and not Scotland's northern?
Well, so I'm not from Manchester. Where I'm from is like 10 miles from Scotland. And like, so my football team, which is called Carlisle, everyone in the rest of the English Football League chants us, "You're just a small town in Scotland." And we absolutely are not in Scotland. There's nothing Scottish about us. Nothing could be more offensive than saying that we're Scottish. But you're right. That's what my girlfriend rags me all the time. She's like, "You're not from the north. Scotland's the north." I'm like, well, what do you know about it? I don't know. No, but it's the northernness in England is absolutely a state of mind as much as it is a place.
Oh, okay. Now that makes a little sense to me, because like, I'm from California, I'm from Southern California, but the worst thing you can say to a Southern Californian, "Oh, I love San Francisco." Or if you go to somebody in San Francisco, I'm like, "I love LA." No, that you basically just threw acid at their face.
So, like Northern England is, when I talk to other American people, the best way I can equate it is it's kind of particularly for, I lived in London for a long time. People down there sort of treat you as though Americans treat Southerners, but like, proper Southern boys from like Alabama and Louisiana.
Okay,
It's
now I get it.
you're all from a foreign country, and you've got really strong accents that all sound kind of the same but a bit different. Like a Scouse and a Manc and a someone from a Geordie from Newcastle. They all sound kind of the same but quite different, but you're all a bit backward, right? That's what people, when they're talking about, when people in England are talking about Northerners, that's basically what they
Okay,
mean.
so
It's
it's basically like some spots of Alabama or Arkansas for us, just
pretty
very,
much,
very
right?
thick accent, a bit, different okay, I get it. Okay, it
And
makes sense.
like, if you said to a Scot you are from Northern Britain, they'd be like, "I am absolutely not. I am from Scotland."
It's so
It's
funny.
so weirdly true. It's such a weirdly try for a tiny, tiny little country. I was talking to another baseball guy last week. I was like, "Look, a long way for us is an hour's drive." The
Yeah,
whole
like
country.
for instance, Los Angeles and San Francisco in the same state, and San Francisco is Northern California, but it's not the northern end of California. That's an 8 hour drive from Los Angeles to San Francisco. So it's long. Like I'm currently in El Paso, Texas right now. And that's 10 hours from Los Angeles. So I'm three states away, and I'm just as close to Los Angeles as I would be if I was in San Francisco right now.
There you go. Look, like, so I'm in Manchester. I could drive to London in 3.5 hours. I could get there on a train in two.
Wow.
This is a tiny, tiny little country.
It's
It's
so
like
funny
the
you say
same
that about
size
Scotland.
as New England, like, and just the corner of New England, like the same size as Maine.
It's so funny when you just said the Scottish thing, because I was watching the Grand Tour not too long ago, and they were in Scotland for this one episode, and they actually said out loud, he's like, "Don't you love it when anybody in Scotland does anything? Oh, a great win for Britain, but when anybody in Scotland loses, oh, he's Scottish."
Well, yeah, Andy Murray, the tennis player. That's the line they always use about him. He's British when he wins and he's Scottish when he loses. Right. Well, I think that's a good place to end. And we're both insulting Scottish people, which is a good
No, I
thing,
love Scottish people. My favorite Doctor Who was Scottish.
There you go.
You
Your
kidding
favorite
me? And my favorite
two.
companion was Scottish as well.
Yeah, your favorite two Doctor Who's are Scottish because David Tennant's Scottish too.
That's right. Look at
Which,
that.
he
See?
doesn't play a Scot in Doctor Who, but he is Scottish.
Yeah, believe it or not, I as weird as it sounds, I've always wanted to go to Scotland more than almost anywhere else in the
There
UK.
you go.
Mainly because I've seen the roads
Oh,
and
yeah.
the scenery just looks untouchable. Man, when I watch Skyfall and I just see when I see
Oh,
Daniel
yeah, it's
Craig standing
beautiful.
next to M looking over those hills, I'm like, I need to go see those. That looks awesome.
Well, I've been trying to go for the last year. I've just rebooked because you can't go anywhere in the UK at the moment. No one's allowed to move anywhere. I've just rebooked a trip to the Highlands of Scotland for the sixth time. Hopefully, I'll get to go in May. So I'll tell you what
One of these days I'll get out there. One of these days my wife and I are finally going to go to the UK. I want to see Wales. I want to see Ireland. I want to see everything. I've just never got a chance, man. All I get to see is everything I see in the BBC and Doctor Who and Top Gear. It's about time I see it for myself.
Awesome. Well, you'll be very welcome. I've told you this privately before, but I'll say it publicly. You'll make many friends. Many, many British baseball fans would love to send you a beer. I'm absolutely sure of it.
Awesome. Well, I'll tell you what, there's one place in Scotland, not Scotland, Ireland, I have to go to. My brother goes to Ireland all the time. He told me there's a bar in the middle of Ireland, a small town. Don't even remember the name of the town. He said, I went in this bar and I fell in love with this small little bar. I said, why? He's like, because you walk into this small little Irish bar in this tiny town in Ireland, and there's more Cleveland Browns gear on the wall than anything in the world that you've ever seen. Wow. They are Cleveland Brown fans. I said, why? Why? Of anything to root for, why? And he said, I don't know. So I asked the owner, and he just said to me, we literally pulled out a hat and picked the name out of the hat, and Browns was it. And we decided to be a Browns bar. I'm like, in a tiny town in Ireland? He's like, yeah, they get together every time the Browns play, and they pack the place. I'm like, what? Browns? Cleveland doesn't root for the Browns.
People have got some wacky reasons to be fans of American sports teams.
But who am I to judge? I root for Liverpool for no reason.
Exactly. I mean, look, I had a similar experience to your brother in New York City. I was walking through Chelsea Village and I saw a shop called, I can't even remember the name of the I think it was Masons of Keswick. And I was like, you know, Keswick is the town where I went to school. Like, that cannot be the same Keswick. And I looked in the window and it had a shirt of Carlisle United Football Club, which is my football club. Huh. And I went to the shop and it was selling like British produce, like Cadbury's chocolate and things like that. And I was like, where is the owner of this shop? I am from Keswick. He's not here. Who are you? Please leave this shop, sir. You know, similar sort of thing. Yeah, man, people are, fandoms are crazy, aren't they?
Oh, yes, they are. Yes, they are. Short for fanatic for a reason.
Absolutely right. So, Cody, I've taken enough of your time. It's been an absolute joy to talk to you, and I'm sure that everyone will have as much fun listening to you as I have had talking to you. So, if people want to keep in touch with you and want to follow on what you're doing, you and Jen are doing on Swings and Misses, where's the best place to find that?
You could find me at Decker6 on Twitter and on Instagram, Anti-Hero Baseball. You could follow her at Jennifer Sturger. You know, our show right now is on a hiatus at the moment. We are currently figuring out what's next for us at the moment. But stay tuned because things are moving. So things are going in the right direction. And I'm really excited to give some pretty big news soon. And just follow us. If anybody ever has any questions, feel free to reach out to me on Twitter. I'm pretty easy to talk to.
You absolutely are. And thank you so much for talking to me this afternoon.
I had an absolute blast. We got to do it again sometime.
Awesome. Let's do it.